Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, going to take a look at birds and bird migration today on the show with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator from the DNR, naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for over 50 years, written a number of books, and has led many bird-watching tours. So as we talk with Bill today, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about migrating birds? What questions do you have about providing shelter maybe and food for those birds? Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email and or a photo to ideas@wpr.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
So the birds have been coming back a bit. We've been still waiting to welcome some of our migrants back. What do we need for all of it to happen?
Well, it's a change in the weather, and we started seeing that last night. And I think for a whole host of outdoor activities, we're going to see a nice improvement here in the coming of spring weather over the next few days. And for those who seriously watch birds, the migration is going to really be picking up. We had the early advance of birds in that latter part of April. And birds always come in sort of a sequence in the same order every year. There's always a few songbirds that start to arrive mid-late April. The big wave is usually after the 1st of May, those first 3 weeks. And even there, there's kind of a progression and sequence as they arrive. Well, just take a look back at the weather here the last few days. It was looking pretty nice. We had that 80 degrees, which was early in the year.
Yeah.
That brought up quite a few birds and got things going. And then we really went backwards with the cold weather, the snow that we had, persistent rain, and most importantly, it was north wind. So yeah, the cold temperature and that north wind, it completely shut things down. Last night was either no wind at all or extremely mild southerly breeze. And with that, a few birds trickled in. I walked around this morning just after sunrise, and a few new arrivals were there. I had one single house wren that showed up a few days ago. Now there's at least three in the neighborhood, so the others are starting to catch up. I know some towhees have been around the area, had the first one yesterday in the backyard. And like I say, they're starting to show up. Well, tonight, we're going to be seeing a little bit more of a warm-up as we go to Friday and the weekend. And the most important thing is we're going to have a south wind.
Yeah.
So that gives the conditions for the birds to ride on. They like that boost. They love to have that tailwind to help them move forward. So for migration, what prepares the birds and tells them it's getting near that time of year to fly for each one of these that comes at different times is the increasing day length. And pretty obvious that sun's coming up pretty darn early this time of year, and we got long evenings. That is something that automatically registers in the bird's brain to tell them that's getting near that migration time. The actual day that they fly has to do with the weather. Changes in barometric pressure and that south wind tells them the winds are right, it's time to go, and this is the day. And I will guarantee you, as we go through between now and Monday, we're going to see a real influx of birds. Normally, May 1st is the day I tell everybody that's when you should be watching for the Baltimore Oriole and hummingbird. Not here yet. At least I haven't seen them, and I haven't seen any reports either.
Usually May 4th for me to see the first Baltimore Oriole.
Yeah, the first week of May.
Yeah.
Well, we're right at the 4th now. Give it a few more days. I will guarantee you, you'll probably have one by over the weekend. They've been waiting, basically. So, yeah, the birds are going to be coming. And this is something that's also a little tricky for bird watchers is that spring is always a little different. If we get, for that latter part of April, warm weather in an early spring, the birds aren't quite ready to move yet for the main wave of songbirds, but the leaves start opening up. And so in years like that, by the time the little warblers get here, which are middle and treetop tiny birds of four inches long, you can't see them. We've had years like that. The other problem is if we have this delay, if this north wind would have continued for another week or two, the birds would have been held up down in Illinois, Missouri. They're getting behind schedule. And then what happens is when they get a strong south wind, they overshoot a lot of Wisconsin, especially the southern part of the state. They go right to the breeding ground, and the migration gets to be really short. So every year is a little different, but I think we're right on schedule now. The birds have been held back, but not too long. South wind is coming, and it's just at the right time here. We're still in that first week of May, And we're going to see a real change in everything here over the next 4 or 5 days.
You know, I always look forward to that first, hearing that first song of the Baltimore Oriole. I know Trina LaSousa, our engineer today, has that up. Trina, have you got that up?
The voice is somewhat similar to Robin.
Yeah.
But it's much clearer. It's always very cheerful and upbeat.
Yeah.
A little bit more of this up and down warble to it. And so, yeah, it's a fairly distinctive song. And I know for people who are just beginning to listen, as you tune your ears in, some of them start to sound alike, but you'll eventually sort them out. But this guy, yeah, he's always a real cheerful, very clear whistle.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing, Larry? I had called in the other day when Scott was on and had a conundrum about a bird of prey that I couldn't identify. And if you remember, it was all white with black wingtips. And I've done some work on it since, and I've determined that it must be an all-white gyrfalcon. Apparently, according to what I've been reading, not uncommon, and they do.
Oh, nuts, you broke up, Mark.
We're losing it. Okay, let me explain a little bit. The gyrfalcon is an Arctic breeder, and they will remain up in that Arctic and far northern reaches throughout most of the year. When it gets real severe up there, they will start to move south. Their main food up there is going to be the ptarmigan, which is a relative of the grouse. There are some sightings of these birds around the Duluth Superior area. They'll be near the harbor there. There's been somewhat traditional hunting the pigeons around the grain elevators. But otherwise, that's an extremely rare bird south of, say, the boreal forest in wintertime and certainly Arctic Canada. All white with black wingtips. Why don't you check your book and take a close look at Northern Harrier, the marsh hawk. And this would be the male. Very grayish. They show it as a light gray, but with good lighting, he looks almost pure white with the black wingtips. They'll have this habit of flapping and then holding their wings above the back. Another good field mark is for both male and female, a white rump patch right above the tail, big white patch. The female is going to be brown with the white patch on the rump. And I bet that's what you've got. A bird of the open country.
Well, we have seen some rare birds here in the state, have we not?
Yes, the bird watchers have been very keen-eyed and keeping their eyes on things. So with the migration picking up and birds moving on the wind, well, there's always an individual out there that just gets off course. Yeah. And especially for some of the longer-distance migrant birds, there's a good chance for them to really cross over the entire Atlantic. So, for example, the ruff, which is a European sandpiper. They'll show up every so often in Wisconsin. About every year or two, we get a sighting of one. And yes, there was one in southern Wisconsin recently. Some other surprises have been two songbirds that normally don't migrate very far, if at all. And one that's been quite a stir is over in Spring Green, a painted redstart. It's a little warbler. And most of our warblers aren't even going to get here for probably the next week or 10 days. They're just starting to show up now. This morning I had the first palm warbler, and he's always an early one among the warbler crowd. This is a bird, very striking, of Mexico and the American Southwest. And way off course, he's in the Spring Green area, but striking bird, beautiful looking. And then a really odd one in Milwaukee area. This is on the south side of Milwaukee, flame-colored tanager, and it's a bird of Mexico. It is not really much of a migrant at all. It doesn't really move down there. There have been a few stray sightings, and those have come from the far southwest of Texas, Arizona. What that bird is doing in Wisconsin, we have no idea. And this does raise a question. How often do some of these birds venture out that far, way out of their range? Well, unless somebody sees it, positively identifies it, and reports it, you know, these things all become kind of unnoticed. And, of course, with the help of a lot of social media and interchange among birders, both to see something unusual and raise the question if you don't know what it is or if you do identify it, to share it with everyone else, to both verify it and have them be able to share in that sighting. Yeah, these things are becoming a little more common. So is it that these birds have always done that, just they went undetected? which is probably more the case. And when they do get up here, the question is, what are they doing that far out of range? I think that still remains a mystery.
Well, and that painted red star, Trina's, I think, has that song. Let's listen to what the song. It's something that maybe you're not accustomed to hearing.
Mm-hmm. A little fast, up and down, sort of a two-part. Do a little bit, and then that second part, you'll see that sort of fades off a little bit. Yeah, something that we certainly don't hear around here.
surely not. Bruce in Dykesville has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for taking my call. Thanks for this program. Bill, always good to hear from you. We've met at a number of Ducks Unlimited events.
Oh, yes.
I live right on the bay, north mm-hmm. of Green Bay, and I'll have my little English cocker out on the beach every morning, and every morning for the last few weeks there have been bluebills and redheads out there, and they will be 50 yards offshore, and as soon as they see him frolicking on the beach, the whole fleet will come in, sometimes 50 of them, and they won't be 25 or 30 feet offshore, and he's clearly interested in them for reasons not conducive to their health, because, you know, he retrieves them in the fall. But I believe that's called tolling. But can you comment on that? I've seen it before, but never to this degree and never, like, every single day.
No, that is very peculiar. I mean, it's one thing for the dog to have interest in the ducks, but the other way around is certainly very odd. I mean, hard to say, really, what they're cueing in on or what the interest is. As a diving duck, of course, you know, sit just offshore far enough, they know the dog can't get out there, so they'll remain in somewhat deeper water. But why they would even come in the first place, that is curious behavior.
Yeah, it's behavior that's actually, as an aside, curious for other animals as well. I know if you're walking along the road and there's a herd of cows out in the pasture, mm-hmm. they'll come right over and take a look. And you wonder, what are they curious about?
Yeah, I mean, I can see where, you know, certain things become conditioned if there's food being offered.
And, yeah.
You know, they'll certainly recognize, hey, you're a source of food. But just seeing your presence or that of a dog, it's really hard to figure out what's in the mind of them with the motivation. There certainly isn't any direct reward out of it. Just, I guess I'd have to say curiosity.
Curiosity.
And they certainly are able to keep that safe distance. So they know how close they can come in and check it out and certainly have no real fear or threat of posed to them.
Bruce, I'm glad you called. Thanks for that
appreciate
story.
It. Yeah, thanks
appreciate
a lot.
It very much. Vivian in Green Bay. We'll go to you. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. A somewhat credible friend recently made a comment about hummingbird migration strategies. I'm skeptical, but it led me to think I don't know much about migration strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And she had said that hummingbirds are hitchhikers.
Nope.
Specifically on a...
The backs of geese?
Goose.
Yes. That story has been around a long time. And, of course, working at Horicon Marsh, where Canada geese were so prominent, I would hear that a lot. Do hummingbirds actually ride on the backs of Canada geese? I have no idea where that myth ever started or where that came from. My guess is that I think people just find it hard to believe that a bird that weighs barely as much as a quarter and is only a little more than 2 inches long can fly on its own all the way to Central America and back again. The fact is they are so fuel efficient. Yes, they do it. The other explanation I would have is I used to share this with people as they were pondering it. You know, Canada geese only fly, the ones here in Wisconsin go down to southern Illinois, western Kentucky, and Tennessee. There's a flock off of the western Hudson Bay that'll get down to Texas. When they really need the flight is to get across the Gulf of Mexico to the Yucatan Peninsula in Central America. And there are no geese going that way. I had one person say, yeah, but they save all the energy to get to the Gulf and then they can go. No, they do that entirely on their own. It is astounding. It's still almost unbelievable that little bird can do it, and not just that it can, but they all do it. Yeah. And again, where the origin of that came from, I have no clue. I've heard it so much over the years, and it is just that. It is a myth. Pass it on. Nothing true.
You can say you talked to a birding expert, and it was debunked. So there you go. Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thanks a lot.
Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator, as we talk birds and bird migration. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, of course, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at birds and bird migration today with retired DNR educator Bill Volkert. Great to have him along. And you can join in with your own questions, comments, experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And while I'm thinking about it, I want to give a big thanks to everybody who donated during our spring member drive. Thanks to you, Wisconsinites have access to WPR's, what I think is an essential public service, and access to this program as part of that. If you missed the drive, you could still join the thousands of dedicated WPR members with a gift right now if you want. It really makes a difference. You just would go to WPR.org, and you can make your gift there, WPR.org. And thanks very much for your support. Well, lots of callers, lots of emails. Let's go to John in South Range and find out what's on John's mind. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry and guest. When I was a Boy Scout, my 100th bird to get my merit badge was the indigo bunting. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen one since, although I have the Merlin, I think it's Merlin, bird identifying app.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And it did identify indigo bunting, but I couldn't see the thing. The other thing, very quickly, when I was in Germany, I showed a short video clip of a hummingbird. They had never seen one.
And in Germany?
I imagine... In Germany, yeah. So do they exist there?
No.
So those are the two things.
Okay. Yeah, hummingbirds are restricted entirely to the Americas. So, they don't have them anywhere outside of North America, Central and South America. Eastern United States, we have primarily one. That is our ruby-throated hummingbird. We do occasionally get some strays from the western birds that have shown up in Wisconsin and east of the Mississippi River, but that's mostly in fall time and migration. As we get down toward Arizona, about 15 species or so are known there in the southwest. As we go further south, you get to Colombia, 165 species. There's about 350 species total, but most of them are in the tropics of South America. Now, when you get to Africa, Southeast Asia, they have a group of birds called the sunbirds. Sunbirds are basically the ecological counterpart of hummingbirds. Hmm. They look like them. In other words, there's a lot of bright colors and a lot of variations among all the different species. There's differences in the bill shape for the special flowers that they use for pollination. They look like hummingbirds. They act like hummingbirds. They do everything that hummingbirds do, except for one thing. They do not hover.
Oh.
So nature's designed them to take that same niche, but they're totally unrelated. But they do the same thing. Those are the sunbirds. We've got hummingbirds.
Ah, there
and
you go.
And Europeans, well, they get neither, unfortunately.
John, there you go. Thank you so much. Wait a minute.
Oh, yeah.
He had another comment there as well.
The indigo bunting, yes.
Yeah.
And indigo bunting, when they first show up, and is another bird we're going to see this week, they oftentimes will hit a bird feeder for some of the small seeds when they first arrive. So people will see them for a week or so. They'll hit the feeders. And then as natural food comes out, they just seem to disappear. And it's commonly perceived that the indigo bunting arrives for a few days in your backyard, and then they seem to migrate north. All they're doing is moving up into the treetops where the food is and where there's good shelter. And as the leaves get nice and thick, as we get into that middle latter part of May, they basically disappear from view. Now, the blue that you see on it is reflected light. It's not a pigment. In other words, it's not an actual blue color. But in the feathers, it's the light sunlight being broken up and reflecting that deep indigo blue. Now, when the bird's sitting on a tree branch or on a wire, the sunlight is usually hitting their back. He's going to look black. So that bright color, if he's sitting in a feeder at eye level, they just are electric and glow. But once they move into the treetops, they're hard to see. both because they're so well masked and camouflaged by the leaves, and the colors just don't stand out. They're up there, and the best way to pick them out then is by call. And so the song of the indigo bunting is really the best giveaway as we get into late May through June. They'll sing to that early part of summer pretty actively.
Yeah. And maybe we might be able to find an indigo bunting. Trina says she's got one, so listen.
Let's play that. Double notes, up and down, up and down.
Yep.
It's a little bubbly. At first it just sounds like any other little twitter, but he has a pattern. It's always two notes, up, down, down, up, up. So that's what we'll listen for, is he repeats those notes, double notes, and a little bit of up and down bubbliness to it. So that's a good giveaway. You'll hear him above all throughout the summer.
John, thanks again. Appreciate it. Margie in Saukville, we'll go to you. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, we moved to this little place on the river in Saukville, and so I don't know much about birds. But what I have noticed is there's a couple types of ducks that when I ask the neighbors, they just call them diving ducks.
Mm-hmm.
They're very white with some black markings. And I was just wondering what their names are.
Okay. Now, first of all, there's about 25 different kinds of ducks in Wisconsin, so it's a big family. The biggest bunch of them will divide up between puddle ducks and diving ducks, or some people refer to them as dabblers and divers. The most common of our dabbling or puddle ducks is the mallard, that bright green head, grayish body, white along the edge of the tail. That's the male. And what's typical is these are birds, they tend to sit very high in the water, and they're feeding in the shallows. They feed by tipping up. So in other words, they're in shallow water. They can reach down with their head and find the food that they need just by, dunking their head under the water.
Sure.
The diving ducks are heavier-bodied birds. They tend to sit lower in the water. They're out on the open water, and they, as the name implies, actually dive for food. They go to the bottom. They'll be feeding, and it depends on the different species, some of them on little tiny snails, clams, some of the invertebrates, and some others, even the plants that are growing in the bottom of some of the deeper lakes and deep water marshes. As you're describing a very white bird with dark, my guess is one of the more common ones would be the scaup. Hunters refer to them as bluebill. There's actually two species, greater scaup, lesser scaup, and that's why some people just write them off as bluebills. Unless you see them up close or really look for detail, they can be a little hard to distinguish. But you're going to see a dark head and breast, almost pure white, especially from a distance of good light in the middle of the body, and then dark on the tail end. Canvasback is a larger bird that also has a very light gray back that almost looks whitish from a distance as well. Those are two typical diving ducks.
Yeah. I was thinking about buffleheads.
Bufflehead is another one. He's got pure white and black. The white is on the head, and then it's black-white kind of mottled pattern, white down the sides with a dark and a folded wing. That's another one, cute little duck.
Yeah, always enjoy seeing those in the spring when they're coming through. Margie, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Marge in Franklin, your turn. Hi, Marge.
Hi. I'm wondering if you could identify or help me identify a bird call that I have been hearing lately since my windows and doors are open.
Okay, sure. We'll give it a try.
I've been hearing it for about the last month or so. It's a very clear two-note call, similar to a cuckoo, but much higher pitched and very clear and beautiful. And
a clear whistle?
It could be a whistle. Yeah, just the two notes.
Is it just a simple?
Yes. Yes.
There you go. Chickadee, black-capped chickadee. And what's interesting with the chickadee is for most birds, the different vocalizations, the different sounds they make, we divide them up between calls and songs. Calls are used throughout the year, different communication among the birds. They'll just use it as, say, contact calls. You know, here I am. There's little chips and chatters as they're feeding or moving through the forest. They may have warning calls for predators, if it's hawks or cats or things like that they see. There's a whole variety of different calls that they'll have as communication. The true song is used in springtime to lure a mate and to get ready for that breeding season. Now, most birds, the calls and the different chip notes that they make, those are very simple, and the song tends to be the more elaborate vocalization. Chickadees are quite the opposite, where the chickadee-dee-dee is a warning call and all the other things you hear out of them. But the song is just that simple little two note. It's a little higher than what I whistle.
Yeah, I think Trina's got it, I think.
Okay, let's hear it from the bird itself. There you go.
There you go, Margie. Marge, is that it?
No, it sounds a little different than that. It's a longer call. It's not so abrupt.
Is it raspy sounding?
Not at all. Very clear.
I'm thinking of Phoebe. That's another one.
Oh.
Phoebe might be it.
Yeah, which is a flycatcher. He's an early migrant, a flycatcher, where the others aren't going to be coming until now these next, 10 days. We'll be seeing them arriving in Wisconsin.
Phoebe could be it.
That's another possibility.
Yeah, it's another possibility, Marge.
And I'll tell you, the problem here is that I can't imitate most of those bird songs unless it's a simple whistle, and even then I'm a little too low, and I can try a little bit. And our ability to describe these vocalizations get to be very hard. And so that's sometimes why I'm guessing a little bit for what people are hearing and how they're trying to describe it. But I'm trying my best for you.
There you go, Marge. Thank you so much for calling. Kathy in Phillips, Wisconsin. We'll go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. I'm so glad to have you guys on the line. This winter, we did have some unusual birds come to our feeder, but the most unusual one, my husband took a picture of it because we'd never seen it before, and we went to the North American bird book, mm-hmm. and we couldn't locate it. So he put that same picture into the Google Lens, and mm-hmm. it came back that this bird was a black lark from Russia or Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah. Hard to imagine.
Yeah, well, we talked at the outset that these things do get pretty far off course. I've never heard of any record of that species in North America. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know, those apps are pretty good, but they're not 100% perfect. So I'm wondering if that's a bit of an error in the app. You might want to check that against the Merlin app. Download that from Cornell University. That's a really good identifier. And for the previous caller, Marge, with the bird song question, that's also got a lot of the bird songs on it. A good way to reference them. And it even has a little bit of an identifier app. Not always 100% foolproof, but they're getting better at it.
Yeah. And you can also, if you've got that photo, Kathy, and you can send it to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, we can take a look at it too.
Yeah, let's do that. And picture's worth 1,000 words. So,
yeah, absolutely. ideas@wpr.org/Larry. If your husband's around and got his phone handy, that'd be great to send that. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. It's a real stretch to think a black lark could make it to Phillips.
As I say, we've had some odd ones getting pretty far off course, but that is one that has not been recorded and does not seem to be a real wanderer as some of the other birds that could show up out of Europe or out of Asia.
Michael in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I often sail on the waters around the Door Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And I often see the white pelicans, but I had never seen them until, I don't know, it can be more than 15 or 20 years ago. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Had never heard of white or inland pelicans, and I saw them once on Lake Mendota. They must have been migrating because I never see them on Lake Mendota. But I understand they're on Lake Koshkonong, and they're certainly around the Upper Door. Where do they go when they migrate, and were they here before? I was born in 1951.
Good question.
I've seen a pair of them on Lake Monona as well. Yes. The other day.
It's getting to be a little more common in Wisconsin. A number of years ago, myself and my good friend Sumner Madison, who's with the Endangered Resources Program, conservation biologist for DNR, we wrote a paper on Wisconsin pelicans. And I went back through all of the historic records, site records of pelicans, And starting about 1939, what was in the Ornithological Society Journal for the state. And what we found was that there was about every 3 to 5 years from the 1940s up through the 70s, there was a sighting of a pelican or three in Wisconsin. And then as we got into the 1980s, a few more were showing up. These were almost always in spring. Sometimes they'd hang around late spring into early summer. And by the time we get into the 1990s, they were starting to show up in some fair numbers. By the mid-90s, first nesting was in Green Bay, then at Horicon Marsh. And now we've got a number of big colonies, especially in the eastern, east-central part of Wisconsin around some of the big marshes. Now, the pelicans, we have two of them in North America, brown and white. The brown pelican is a coastal bird. So you get down along the Gulf Coast and all throughout the coastal areas of South America, you'll see these birds sitting on the wharfs, and they feed by flying, looking for schools of fish. And you may have seen this on the nature specials where they will actually fold their wings, dive in into the water, go to quite a depth, and then snap these fish up. White pelicans have a different technique. They'll be swimming in a flock, and they'll look for a school of fish, and they will basically herd them. They'll see some spread out. They'll move those fish, and when they get them concentrated, that big bucket mouth, they'll be using that just to scoop them up. Now, the white pelican winters in the southern states and along the Gulf Coast, and its nesting range is in the prairies, prairie states of the Dakotas, actually out to Yellowstone, and south central parts of that prairie province area of Canada. Now, if you draw a line from, say, Georgia, Florida, over to, say, the Dakotas, these birds are kind of coming close to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Actually, we find the migration. They don't like to go over forested areas, so they don't go across the Appalachians. They start to move north, hit the Appalachians, shift over to the Mississippi River, follow that up, and then a little bit more, make a left turn out to the prairie breeding grounds. They don't start to nest until they're about 4, 5, 6 years old. So there's always this non-breeding cohort among the flock. And those are the birds that we tended to see that showed up in Wisconsin for many years. A bird that's not really in a rush to get to the breeding grounds. He gets off course a bit. He hangs out in Wisconsin. Those are the early records. It seemed to coincide with the big drought that Wisconsin experienced in 1988-89 out in the prairies. It was 10 years of drought. And a lot of these wetlands in the prairie pothole area were starting to dry up, while the pelicans nest out on islands where they're free from predators. As those wetlands were drying up, coyotes, raccoons, and others had access to the nesting colony. And with that, they started to abandon some of those colonies, were looking for new sites, and they started showing up in Wisconsin and showed an eastward expansion of the population. They're now established in Wisconsin for the last 25 years. They've been nesting in the state. And we see both big rafts of non-breeders sitting on these lakes and just loafing and feeding, and actual breeding in a number of sites.
Yeah, that's a great history. And I think Trina might have an American white pelican.
Just a croak or a grunt. There's a beautiful song, isn't it? They sound disgruntled.
Michael, there you go. Thank you very much for calling.
I appreciate your
call.
That was
great. Yeah, they are fun to see. It's almost startling to see the other morning when I was out for my morning jog. There was a pair out on Lake Monona, and it was close to the shore, and it was.
And that is a big bird.
Yeah,
everybody knows bald eagles are very, very large, no doubt. 6 to 7 foot wingspread. Pelicans, it's 9 to 9.5 foot wingspread. And body weight, they'll get over 25, 30 pounds.
Yeah.
They are a big, chunky bird. It takes them a while to get off the water. So, yeah, it's about as big as some of our flying birds will get in the Midwest.
Yeah, they're pretty easy to spot.
Can't miss them, yep.
Mark in Sussex, on to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
I wanted to fill you in a little bit on that gentleman with his dog who walks along the bay.
Yeah.
There is a breed that I was watching one of those kennel shows, Kennel Club, and there's a duck trolling retriever, and that is their job, to run back and forth on the beach and get the ducks to come close enough.
Really? So this is a regular habit that they just seem to home in on these retrievers, and just out of curiosity, just come in.
I never could figure out. I could never figure out how that would work, but the fellow that called in just confirmed it. So.
And I'm still miffed at to what is the attraction? Why? What is it about the ducks that's in it for them? Just curiosity.
Must be. There's a lot more to animals than anybody imagines.
Yep.
You're right about that, Mark.
They must recognize them as a trolling bird named a duck or a dog and just go in there. Yeah, curious.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Oh, you learned something.
It's not a fluke of a behavior.
Learn something new every day. Rusty and Dalton, your turn. Hi, Rusty.
Hi. Just a couple days ago, I was sitting in my living room looking at the birds at my feeder. Mm-hmm. And something unusual showed up, and I headed for my field guide, and it is a myrtle warbler.
Ah, yes.
And so I just wanted to report that.
Great. Well, thanks. And myrtle warbler is the old name for the bird, so an older book will have it under that name. More recent publications will call it yellow-rumped warbler, and that's because there were originally two different warblers, very close relatives, one in the East United States called the myrtle, and out west, the Audubon's warbler. And looking at the genetics of the birds, they figure they're really awful close, and it's hard to really separate them. And this is still a matter of debate. So what they did is they lumped them. In other words, it's one species, so you have to give it a common name, which is yellow-rumped warbler, or some of the bird watchers call them butterbuts. And you have an eastern and western race of them. It's the earliest of our warblers that is really out of sequence of the rest. The big warbler migration is the first 3 weeks of May, and we're right on the cusp of that. They're about to come. Myrtle warbler or the yellow rump, he'll show up second week of April, sometimes the first week even. He's much earlier than the rest, and sometimes when they show up that early, they'll come to a feeder, taking especially the suet. As an early arrival, I have not yet seen them in really big numbers, and I think that our persistent cold weather that we had to warm up a little early in the migration, so a few of them got here, and then it stalled out. So they're a little behind schedule for their normal arrival. I think we're going to see some big numbers coming in over the weekend now, and we'll also see the first advance of the rest of the warblers are just on schedule for them.
And I think Trina has the yellow-rumped warbler. Let's listen.
Mm-hmm. And it's this very distinctive little whistles, and it's sort of two-part, and then he fades out.
Yeah.
So that second part, it descends on it. He also has a very distinctive call note. It took me a while to pick it up, and now I do not miss it. It's not a sharp chip like a sparrow. It's not a tsk, but a little sputter to it. And they'll be doing a lot of that overhead. And once I got that in my head, I cannot miss them. Over the winter, I was down in Dominican Republic. I did not know that some of the population of yellow rumps overwintered. I heard that call one single time, and I knew right away, there's a yellow rump. And sure enough, there he was. So, yeah, easy to pick out by call and song. They'll be heading to, there's a little bit of nesting on far northern Door County, northern Wisconsin, and then into Canada. And so for all of the rest of us in central and southern Wisconsin, it's just a migrant. You'll be enjoying them for the next 2.5 weeks or so. So I think we'll see some pretty big numbers here with the south wind.
Rusty, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator. I'm Larry Mueller, and you, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking birds today with Bill Volker, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He's retired, but he does a lot of speaking. He's always into something. And as you can tell, he knows an awful lot about birds. And we'll go right back to our phones. And Kathy in Watertown, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks for the show. I have a question about a brown thrasher. Mm-hmm. So we had a brown thrasher in our yard yesterday here in Watertown City Yard. And I know I'm familiar with brown thrashers, the long tail, that beautiful color in the back, the heavily streaked breast, and that unique beak. Mm-hmm. This one had a brown eye. It looked like an adult. And so I'm just wondering if you can speak about brown-eyed brown thrashers.
Yeah, that's actually a matter of age. That as that's probably a bird from last year, and so the eye color will deepen and become a little richer. We see this in a close relative of it, a little bit later migrant, the catbird, which will also be coming here in the next week or so. The young ones of the year have a very brownish color eye. As the adult, it'll be a deep reddish brown color. So a number of birds will have these changing eye color with age. Sometimes it actually works as a technique for aging birds, especially for those of us who band birds, where you have them in the hand for research and mark them. So, yeah, you're probably seeing a bird that's still fully maturing.
And we've got that song Trina has, the brown thrush.
And he'll go on for a while.
They do go on for a while.
Yeah. Now, this is an interesting family. Scientific name is Mimidae. He's a mimic. And so what you hear there is usually they're double paired. So you hear that. So in the voices, though, if you listen close enough to some of the individuals, they'll actually bring in those paired notes, the call of a robin, the voice of a cardinal. They'll make their own little chatter. They'll pick up somebody else's. It becomes part of a very elaborate vocalization for the bird. But he always has them as sort of paired or doubled notes and will go on. A close relative, especially more in the eastern and southern United States, is the mockingbird. And then the catbird has a very similar long chatter like that. But he doesn't tend to repeat himself, and it's not quite as sharp or raspy as the brown thrasher's call.
Kathy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill and Mary emailed to ask for the website for reporting migrating birds. They saw a ruby-crowned kinglet in Sheboygan yesterday.
Yes. Probably there's a couple of places now to do so. Extremely rare sightings. The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology has a rare records report. Ruby-crowned kinglet is a fairly regular occurring bird, though he's very small. I mean, he's even smaller than chickadee, so it's something that I think is oftentimes overlooked. But you can also share that the Wisconsin Birding Network, wisbird.com. That's one. There's also a Facebook page that they run through the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. We always used Wisbird, and now people are sort of diversifying in a few other chat groups. So, yeah, a couple of places that you could share that or report it to. The real keeper of the records of birds is the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. The other thing that people can do is to put their sightings on eBird.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. If you're not using eBird, it is becoming something of not only statewide, continental, but worldwide.
Worldwide.
And people are using it all throughout on so many countries. What eBird is an app from the Cornell University, and it's a free download. So you can download the program, and then you go to the bird packs, so the little packages, and you look for the upper Midwest. And they'll have them for all kinds of countries. They keep developing more of these as you go. Well, that's for Merlin. But eBird, it's a reporting thing, so you'll just look for your location. And a checklist comes up. So what you'll do is you'll go into the checklist, and you'll just hit start checklist for the day. It'll record your GPS coordinates and your routes. You can see where you walked and how long or you drove. And then you just record your sightings on there. So I was out this morning. I put mine in, and I had 36 birds around the house in a half hour before I left. And so I recorded, yes, there were 6 Canada geese. I did have ruby-crowned kinglets. Sighted one, heard another one singing. The first yellow rump, palm warbler, a couple of yellow rumps were chipping and calling. One was singing. So you just add in the number of birds, and then you can review your list and submit it. And that will go then to a major database. And in doing so, if they find something extremely rare, they will actually referee that and question it. You can attach a photo I was talking to a fellow bird bander last week, and she was reporting summer tanager. It was getting red flagged. They're like, are you sure that's what you're seeing at this time of year? She sent the photos, like, yes, there it is. So, yeah, you can verify those things. And what they're using now is all this data from bird watchers. You can even watch like a little video of the migration of these birds, like, say, hummingbirds. You'll see when they're being reported right along the Texas and southern coast. You'll see as they're advancing north and who's seeing them at what time. And like a movie, you'll actually see these birds move north. People see them in summer and then retreat again. And this is everybody's sightings of these birds throughout the seasons. So, yeah,
pretty
eBird
cool.
is a really good way to do so. If you're not using it, it's a free download.
Gary in Fond du Lac County, your turn, Gary. Hi.
Hi there. Got a question on ospreys.
Mm-hmm.
We've had ospreys in our area regularly. And a year ago last fall, we were able to get a osprey nest erected.
Okay, you got a platform. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we had a successful pair came in.
Oh, good.
Went through all the nest building and mating rituals, and were camped out up there, and then they were gone. Occasionally, we had a flyby, but nothing more of the mating pair.
Well, give it a little time.
This year we've had no sightings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, give it a little time. What you need is a pair to find it, for one, and to actually use it and be successful in nesting. And one of the problems is usually the birds that find the new platforms are first-time nesting pair. They're not tied to anything, and so they're pioneering. They're looking around. If they're not, because they haven't done it before, they're not always successful. And if they're not, they may not come back again because it didn't work for them. Those birds who are successful realize, hey, this is secure. It's not in conflict with any other birds. It's a safe area. We raised a family there. Worked last year, so why not try again? So, yeah, just leave it up. It'll take a while. And I actually live in far southern Fond du Lac County. So the first pair you had was Wolf Lake. There's been a nesting pair for over 25 years down in Dundee. They've been nesting there. So we've got osprey in a couple of sites in Fond du Lac County. It's a bird that's more common in the central northern part of Wisconsin around the lakes because fish is 100% their diet. But, it is a bird that has been slowly increasing. One of the things that's holding them down is the success of the bald eagles. There is a little bit of a competition for fish and food on those lakes. And oftentimes eagles will get in there and hold the osprey back from establishing or getting a foothold.
Mm. Gary, thanks. Appreciate the call. Stephen Little Swambigo, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning, guys. Appreciate the show.
Sure.
We have a habitat pole about 30 yards from the house. And 3 years ago, Parapileated made a nest in it. Just before the eggs hatched, a raccoon or something got in and got the eggs.
Mm.
This spring, we had a wood duck pair that nested in it. And I put a trail cam up.
Mm-hmm.
Hadn't seen the wood ducks near the tree for a couple days. Looked at the trail cam, and there's pictures of a female red-bellied woodpecker throwing the wood duck eggs out.
Really?
And I was wondering if you've ever heard of anything like that.
Wow, that is peculiar.
Oh, wow.
That's a pretty big thing for a red-bellied woodpecker to handle, first of all. That is peculiar. So, yeah, I've got no explanation of that one. It's the first time I've actually come across that. If you do have predators, especially the raccoons climbing up it, what I would suggest is if you can attach sheet metal, maybe about 18 inches in height, and just wrap it around there, something that they can't grab on. That's one of the problems for these cavity nesters is we got an awful lot of raccoons, and this time of year they are nest predators for those cavity nesters. But, yeah, red-bellied woodpecker actually throwing out the eggs to make room. That is really an odd one. And I guess it's just one of those things. You watch wildlife long enough, and there's always going to be something new. Yeah, that is really peculiar and first time I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. John emailed wondering about diseases and bird feeders. He hasn't filled his feeders since he heard about this a while back. about potential disease spread.
Yeah, bird flu was a big issue last summer, and we're kind of standing by to see if it emerges again. It's more of a summer disease. It was devastating for Caspian terns on Lake Michigan last year. And, yeah, they even found California condors, a few of them that were infected by that. So, yeah, there's a real worry about that. Around bird feeders, probably your biggest one is going to be salmonella. And what happens there is a sick bird comes in. They're passing the bacteria through their droppings. It's on the ground, and the other birds are feeding nearby, and you start a little bit of an epidemic there. Yeah, you want to keep your feeding station clean. If you have a lot of waste seed, and especially from the winter now, rake it up, clean it up a little bit, and take your feeders next time they're empty and disinfect them. Use a light solution of bleach and warm water. Soak them in there for a little bit. Rinse them good. Completely dry them out because you don't want the seed to get wet. And start over again and just watch a little bit. We find that it's usually not a big problem if people keep a good sanitary condition.
Bill Volkert, our guest. He'll be with us till 12:30 today on the Ideas Network. It's always great to have Bill come by. Shelley in Reeseville has a question for it. Shelley, hang on there because we're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mehler. And again, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A look at birds on the program today. Larry Mehler here with my great guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He's been doing it a long, long time, as you can tell with the vast knowledge he has about birds and birding. Great to have him along. Shelley in Reeseville has been waiting a bit, Bill, so let's go and see what's on Shelley's mind. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. So I'm from a town called Reeseville, which is in Dodge County, Wisconsin. I'm more kind of southern Dodge, but
I know where it is.
So, yeah. So I was wondering, I was up north. I got a place up there up by Elko, kind of near Rhinelander.
Yeah.
And I was hearing a bird up there, and I could never, I think I called even last year in, and they couldn't figure it out. But so I think I know what it is. I think it's called a wood thrush.
Oh,
and
yes.
I describe it as like a echoing flute. It
yes.
is the most beautiful sound you have ever heard.
Yes.
I was just wondering if those birds were down here.
Yes, wood thrush nests across much of Wisconsin and even into Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, the eastern U.S. It is a bird population that has declined somewhat over the years, winter in Central America for the most part. But, yeah, it is just almost a magical sound. And
Trina has that.
Yeah, very flute-like, very echoing. Described as eole. Yeah.
That's it, too.
Mm-hmm. As you get into more northern third of Wisconsin, northern half, the hermit thrush is a close relative, sings somewhat similar, usually starts with two introductory notes and kind of a flute-like little warble. That's a close relative. So those are the two most common of the nesting thrushes. And, well, the most common, the robin. That's in the same family.
Shelley, thank you so much for calling. Looking at our emails, remember we talked with Kathy earlier, and mm-hmm. she said they had a photo of, or they had seen a black lark, which is, you'd find them in Russia typically. Mm-hmm. And we asked her to send some photos if she had them, and she did send some photos. And Bill, we had a look at those photos.
Yes, and yeah, pictures are certainly worth an awful lot more than any description. It turns out to be an extremely common bird. It's red-winged blackbird, but I'll tell you what fooled the observer on this one, and I used to get this a lot. It's only showing the yellow, a little yellow stripe on the wing, where red-winged blackbird we know for that brilliant scarlet, reddish-orange, yeah. bordered by yellow. I used to get this question all the time at Horicon Marsh. How come some of the red-winged blackbirds only have yellow? How come the others have this bright red? they all have that. They're just covering it up. It's the wing covert. The smaller feathers are covering it. The reason for that, and this one is seen at a feeder, it's off its nesting territory. So when they're on their nesting territory, they're actually displaying, they're claiming that piece of marsh, and they're trying to both keep the other males away, saying, this is my piece right here, this is my territory, stay away, and of course, at the same time, attracting a female. They're going to flash those colors, do the full song, spread those wings, show the bright epaulets on the shoulders, and spread the tail to make themselves very visible. When they're off the territory, they cover that up very commonly. So when they come to your feeder, you're going to see just the yellow. The reason for that is because what that does for other males, it exhibits a flight or fight response. In other words, if I'm in my backyard and I'm claiming, hey, this is my property, stay off, you know, people may defend that. Well, when you get off of your property now, and I used to explain this to the kids, you know, you can have a little bit of an attitude on your front porch, like, I don't want anybody here right now. This is my place, okay? So that's the sort of attitude that bird has. But when he gets off to the feeder, it's kind of like going to the shopping mall. You don't walk around with that attitude. Somebody's going to get into a fight. So it's, you know, good morning, how are you? You cover up the epaulets. You're just, I'm just passing through, just feeding. So you don't elicit that response. And that's why you're seeing just that little bit of yellow. It's all covered up. And it looks like two completely different birds. So I can see the mistake.
We have Chris emailed in Vernon County. They have a flock of yellow rumps who've been hanging around for over a week now and a small flock of white-throated sparrows. And today they heard and then saw a male northern Baltimore Oriole.
All right. Hey, first
it feels
one.
Like spring.
Yeah, it sure does.
Chris says.
And he came in last night. Not a big rush, and that's why I think we're only going to get a few reports, because I looked this morning and it was zero wind, but it, what my weather station had picked up was very light south-southwest, a little puff. In other words, there was no north wind holding them back, but there also wasn't the south wind to push them. A couple of birds felt the urge. They were in good condition, had the energy. They figured, let's go with it. They're not being held back. Tonight, when we get a strong wind, they're going to get that aid, and we're going to see everybody else jump on the train, and we're going to start seeing them really coming in the next few days.
Pete in McQuantico emailed to ask how a brown-headed cowbird knows that it's a brown-headed cowbird if it isn't raised by their cowbird parents. Don't they imprint on their adoptive parents? And if not, how do they know who to flock and mate with?
I'm going to give you a kind of a cheap answer, and we'll just call it instinct. What we mean by here is, yes, they do this automatically, but we also don't have a good explanation. It seems to be something that's just heredity, that it's almost in the same way that other physical characteristics are passed on genetically, so is this somewhat memory passed on among them. And so where most birds actually learn their song from the adults, and there's actually dialects among some birds across the United States because different regions will sing a little different and they'll learn a little variation. Here, this bird must somehow have it imprinted in its head. You don't pick up any trait from your parents because they're not really your parents. You are a brown-headed cowbird, and your job is to exploit somebody else's nest and have them raise your young. So there must be some sort of a blockage in that sort of learning that other birds pick up. And like I say, it's a cheap answer. I'll just call it instinct, which means, yes, they do it automatically, but we still don't know how.
Laura emailed to say there have been several Wisconsin sightings of European goldfinches. She's wondering if you can comment on the predicted spread of this bird's range. She says, also as an aside, she remembers when house finches first arrived in southern Wisconsin.
Yes. The house finch is a native bird to the western U.S. It was in the pet trade. It was very common in the East Coast, Boston and New York. And it was in the late 1940s, the Fish and Wildlife Service actually put its foot down because people were keeping what were a native bird, which are all protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so with that, rather than go all the way over to the western United States and release them, the cage bird store said, well, we can't keep them anymore. They opened doors and let them go. They actually established a breeding population and started then increasing and spreading. And by the 1970s, we were seeing the first one in Wisconsin. And it was about in the mid-late 80s, the eastern population met the western population. So now we've got house finches all across the U.S., which was normally a western bird. The European goldfinch, as the name implies, is, of course, a counterpart to the American goldfinch. It was also in the pet trade. And the best evidence we have for this, it seems that it was a pet store owner southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois had the birds and released them either accidentally or intentionally. And they're adapted to the climate and the environment, and they began to nest. And it's actually, there was an article recently that, by Julie Craves from University of Michigan, who looked at the establishment and spread of this bird population as a nesting bird in the upper Midwest. And also in the upcoming Breeding Bird Atlas, we'll have records of where the bird has nested and been recorded in Wisconsin. Yeah, it looks like it's here to stay. And it seems to be becoming more common. I just hope that there is no direct competition between that and our American goldfinch. I always have concerns when we bring any sort of exotic species in because we don't know what the impact will be on the native fauna or flora until it's too late and it becomes successfully established. So we all know the fate of those that aren't good actors that are end up becoming the invasive species. So you never know what will or will not be somewhat benign out there.
Mike in Minocqua has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was just wondering, we had that late April warm-up, and I was starting to see juncos and sparrows and things that I would expect to see as the ground got uncovered from all the snow we had. Mm-hmm. And then we had the return of winter, and we had some pretty heavy snowfall. The ground was almost completely covered, and we had some pretty cool nights down into the 20s. Consistently, right. And all of a sudden I had mixed aggregations or flocks of warblers show up, multiple species, some that I wasn't used to seeing, and I wondered what were they doing in northern Wisconsin in the midst of all that wintry weather.
Yeah, there were a couple of scattered reports, probably with that, say, 4 or 5 days of 75, 80 degrees we had across most of Wisconsin, and, of course, a lot of strong south wind. A little early for migration for most of these birds, but we did have a couple of early sightings of Cape May warbler and a couple of others that we expect, you know, several weeks later. So a few of those birds did head out a little bit sooner than they should have and then got caught with that weather. Birds can be pretty tough, but we never know just how well some of those that are more adapted to, say, our late spring and summer weather are going to be able to make it through, especially if they fly and they're already exhausted themselves, using up a lot of energy, and now find that there's not a lot of readily available food to make up for it. It can be quite stressful. Mm-hmm. So, we'll have to see. Fortunately, for most of the individuals, it was still too early, and they were holding back. So we're glad that weather... the real warm-up and then the snow and the cold weather came at about the time it did, so it didn't advance too many birds and put them in harm's way.
Thanks again, Mike, for calling. Pat in Elm Grove emailed, they just won a bluebird house in a silent auction and was wondering if it's too late to set it up this year.
I would get it up very quickly. Bluebirds are on the nest, but not everybody starts at the same time. So, do get it out. And if you're looking for any information of designs, if you want to build your own, where to place them, how to manage them, how to inspect them, I would strongly recommend you go to the website of the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. They've got a lot of good information that can help you in setting up your bluebird box and monitoring them.
Yeah, great site. Denise and Boyd said they hadn't seen bluebirds since the die-off in Texas, so they were excited to see several looking over their houses. But robins keep chasing them away. The houses are well-spaced from trees and other houses, and wondering what's going on.
Yeah, robins, like some other birds, can get a little aggressive around their territories when they're nesting. Of course, they're not looking for the same place as the bluebirds, but they may be feeding, though it's even going to be different food in large part, feeding in the same area, so they may be kind of claiming some of that and can be a little bit of a harassment for the bluebirds. There's not direct competition, but sometimes there's a little bit of lack of tolerance when they get fired up here during the springtime.
Chris in Black Creek, we'll go to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Larry, this is a good one. So for about almost 25 years, I noticed that the black-hooded chickadee seems to communicate state to state across the United States. And even my brothers and friends use this method. And when a chickadee goes chickadee-dee-dee, that means rain's coming in. But when they go chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee, then it's clear weather. So we know.
What do you think? What do you think, Bill?
I think it's probably a bit of a coincidence there. What we do find is that is actually a bit of a warning call. It's like I said earlier, this is call. It's one of the more complex vocalizations. And what the researchers found is the more DDDs, the more intensive the warning is. So you will hear it quite commonly. And that's because they're simply saying, hey, people over here. If it's a predator in the area, they'll get a little bit more excited with that. And it's always to do with ground predators. You, me, cats, weasels, whatever else. They have a completely different call for an aerial predator. You don't want to be that noise if it's a Cooper's hawk flying over. So they'll actually do a very high, what they call a high Z, a real thin little call, hard to localize where it comes from, and everybody dives down and freezes. And they even have an all-clear signal. UW-Milwaukee spent years and years trying to crack the code and decipher the language of chickadees. And what they would do is, it's hard to remember all the variations. They would use sonograms, tape recorders, and then the voice print. So we can now take a look at exactly the call they're giving, if it's the same one that we thought we heard, and try to watch them from a blind and associate that with behavior. And this is where they found that they have a different predator call for ground predators, for aerial predators, all clear signal, and even more DDDD, the more intense or the warning is. So that's maybe a little coincidence for the weather, but yeah, it's really a warning call.
Really interesting. Thanks for that comment. Appreciate it. Phil in Marshfield emailed, they have robins that built a beautiful nest over their neighbor's porch light. Wonderful construction, but only occasionally visited by robins. Why would they build such a beautiful nest and then not occupy it?
Well, they're still in the early stages, and what will happen is birds will spend some time to actually construct the nest, and then they'll lay an egg in it every day or two to make sure everybody hatches out on the same day, and then that they jump the nest at the same time. They don't start incubating the eggs until the clutch is complete, which will be 3 to 5 eggs. So what they're doing now is they just finish the construction, they're getting ready to start laying the eggs, and they're going to wait until they have all the complement of eggs in the nest, and then you'll see her there. The old front porch light is a commonplace for them. You're not allowed by the federal laws to destroy those nests once they're up. The big thing is if that's the wrong place, and they're going to be out there either making a mess on your front doorstep or getting aggressive with people coming to your door, you want to discourage them before they start setting up. Cover that up somehow, put a physical little barrier so they can't build on it, give them a different place. They'll certainly find something a little bit more suitable that they're not in your way. It's obviously convenient for them. They like it.
Yeah.
It's sheltered from the weather. They've got the eaves over their head, but it's sometimes the wrong door if that's the main one we're using.
Ralph and Hayward emailed to ask if repeated hearings of a bird song on Merlin, say over the span of a day or two, count as noting a bird coming through the area while migrating or settling. He knows this is controversial.
Identifying it by sound? Is that what I'm getting here?
I think so. He repeated hearings of a bird song, and he hears it on Merlin.
Okay.
If you hear that over the span of a couple of days, does that count as noting a bird coming through?
Oh, if that you're actually just hearing the app? Well, if you're just hearing the recording of it, you could play that any time of the year. It's certainly good for practice and tuning up and getting the sound in your head when you hear it in the wild, but this wouldn't be a legitimate sighting of the bird. If you're identifying birds simply by call, that is acceptable by the American Birding Association as identification, and even under the eBird, if you just simply hear it. The problem, though, is that people are at different stages of their learning of bird songs and their ability to identify them. So with that, sometimes there's a little bit of a question, is that really what you heard? A good example of this is we were conducting breeding bird surveys in Wisconsin. We still do this every year. About 90 routes across Wisconsin to try to monitor birds that nest in Wisconsin. And we're looking for expert birders who really have a lot of good experience in sighting and listening for birds. And they move along a route in 3 minutes. They identify all the birds they see or hear. Well, there's what we call an observer bias. How good is the person who's actually doing this?
Yeah.
And in the analysis that we did a number of years ago, what they found was a very rich area. I think it was down toward Dodgeville, by Governor Dodge Park. Cerulean warbler, which is not that common in Wisconsin, but there are a few good strongholds. What they notice is over the many years of the records, here cerulean warbler was seen every single year, and then for 7 years straight, no recording of it, and then it showed up again. And they're wondering, well, what does this mean for the bird, that it comes and the whole population would just disappear for 7 years and then it come back again? How do you develop a conservation plan for something that's that fickle? When they looked a little closer at it, what they found was, well, for 7 years, they had a different observer who just did not know that call or that song. And so the bird went unrecognized. So, yeah, your ability to actually learn the birds, especially when we're looking for people to identify them, that's something that we're always looking for, people with that experience. I'd like to make a little comment about bird songs real quickly here before we wrap up. You know, one thing I've noticed over the years is when birds first arrive, and we're going to see this the next few days, commonly you'll see them and they won't sing at all the first day. Or I've had this happen where you'll hear a bird one time, it gets your attention, like, hey, I think I just heard a yellow warbler, and then you wait to confirm it and you'll never hear him again. Not that day. The next day he may be singing his head off. What happens is, I guess the quick explanation is, well, he just migrated all that distance and he's just plain tired. He's too tired to sing, which isn't too far off the fact he's expended so much energy in migration. He's going to feed. He doesn't have a lot of time to sing. Once he's recovered, then, of course, he'll start to sing and he's got some time and some extra energy to do so. For people who want to learn songs, it's basically like learning a foreign language. It takes practice. And if you ever tried to pick up a foreign language, you know it's not easy and it takes work. And this is something that's just going to take some time if people want to learn the birds by their song. Merlin and other apps are good. Going to a nature center or going on a hike with an expert, they can point them out and give you good hints. And a little at a time, you can learn these birds and learn their songs, and it adds a whole nother dimension to the enjoyment of birds. I enjoy looking at them as much as I hear singing them, hearing them sing. My problem is when I travel, my ears are always open, but I'm in new places and I don't know what I'm listening to. So I'm a beginner all over again. I've got to see birds to identify them. So it is a long practice, and it really gets tough for some of these migrants like the warblers. Some of these birds are going to pass through for only 2 or 3 weeks. So you've got that quick exposure. You've got 2 weeks to try to learn something, get it in your head, and then 50 weeks to forget about it until next spring. So it's a long process. The recording certainly help. It'll help you to try to pick that up. And essentially, it's a skill each person has to develop in their own. Others can give you hints and help you along the way. But it just takes time. It takes practice. But it opens up a whole nother world.
It does indeed. And Bill, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks so much, Larry. I enjoy talking about birds with you and everyone else out there. Thanks
and your website, you have a website, do you not?
Yes, very easy. It's BillVolkert.com. My presentations are on there. We're putting together a tour to Nicaragua next February. That's posted there. And, yeah, a little bit of background information is all on there, especially for groups that are looking for a speaker. I'm always glad to accommodate.
Bill Volkert, our guest, wildlife educator, retired from the DNR after working at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. And he knows a lot, doesn't he? I always learn something when Bill's on the show. Well, tomorrow, Melinda Myers is back for Garden Talk, and I always learn something from her too. We're going to talk about gardens that help support pollinators. That's Friday. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.